You have reached a phone call from Paul, a Literary Hub podcast. To hear more, visit lithub.com. Part 2 of Paul Holden Graber's conversation with William Gibson.
I've found that it's more challenging and probably literally impossible to imagine the world prior to our own experience of media than it is to imagine media that don't exist. And I can barely remember the world prior to my experience of television. So that gives me something to work with. But what I think is more interesting is to listen to audio recordings of music played by musicians who had never heard recorded music. And it's possible. It's possible to do that. I think there may actually be a few specialist collections that amount to a selection of that kind of music. And it certainly sounds strange. It doesn't sound like any later music.
What music in particular have you listened to, and why is it strange? I mean, I find myself now listening to you talk about this completely curious and nearly transposed, very eager to hear it.
I'm trying to. Oh, it's been probably 20 years since I've looked into it. So I'd have to go back. I think there is a collection, one particular collection of CDs of very, very early recordings of music. And those recordings were so early that they amounted to anthropological field recordings, which in some cases they were. So that the person who was playing or singing who's being recorded has no idea of the existence of recorded music or of what is being done. They don't know they're being recorded. They've only heard themselves sing or another sing, another person singing. And I can't possibly describe what the exact difference is. But I think there's really a difference.
And the difference is that you don't have any point of comparison, and that you don't really know what a recording sounds like. It's we're going back to this notion of a.
I think that your. If you had never heard recorded music and you didn't have it as a category of experience, if it simply had never existed for you, I say, you know, I think that your concept of what music is would be. Fantastically different. Something that's happened, the change that's occurred over the course of my own life that I think somewhat puts this vague claim I'm making into perspective, is the way in which seeing a film used to be something that was so dependent on so many factors that it made it largely unrepeatable. You could see the film on its theatrical release, but unless you lived in, say, New York, there were no repertory cinemas. So people saw a film once and then lived with it in memory. There was no television. There were no videotapes of films. The film existed primarily in memory, and the experience of actually seeing it was very intense. I suppose if you'd been immediately struck by some particular classic, you could have gone, you could have, you know, paid another ticket or hidden the theater, seen it.
No, but you're saying something so interesting, because that means that what you commit to memory, if it's not readily available, the memory of it, I suppose, remains much more pungent and much stronger.
It has some other quality. I first saw, for instance, Chris Marker's La Jetée,
yes,
in a film history course when I was an undergraduate at the University of British Columbia. I had been vaguely aware of it earlier, because it is, you know, technically a science fiction film, even though it's a short avant-garde French film. I had in my life prior to that no opportunity whatever to see any avant-garde short French films, and I had no idea what to expect. I wasn't really expecting very much, and it had this extraordinarily profound effect on me, and it's very, very brief. And I actually left the lecture hall feeling uneasily that I had somehow, something had happened, I'd experienced some sort of transformation, and I didn't know what it was. Then I was unable to see it again for a decade. I mean, I suppose I could have sought it out, but just as your average civilian person who mainly reads books, it didn't come my way. There were no videos, no video rental places. I actually saw it before videotape was generally available. So it had to be film projected on a projector. And because I wasn't really a cinephile, I would have had to belong to the National Film Board Cinema Club in order to see La Jetée again. But then I saw it on television, just randomly on CBC, and then again didn't see it for years after that. Now anyone in the world can watch it repeatedly on YouTube at any time. And I think there's a fundamental difference in those two modes of being. And I don't, while I can have a certain nostalgia.
I was going to ask.
The earlier mode, it doesn't quite go so far as saying, yes, we should try to get back to that. Let's not have experiences be quite so universally available. I mean, that doesn't seem to be the answer either.
No, but what is? I mean, you know, I was going to ask you a question about nostalgia, because I try to resist it, but I'm weak and unable to, in some sense. I do have a nostalgia for long playing records, which I find I wish I didn't have it, but I love the kind of tactile inebriation, the gesture of putting on a distinct piece of music that isn't part of you know, a huge collection on one's iPod. There's something about it that makes the occasion of listening perhaps a little more special.
I agree. I have that too. The remarkable thing is how many younger people apparently have that. And I'm always, if I ever have called to go into Urban Outfitters, the thing that always strikes me is their selection of portable phonographs.
I know. They have a whole new line of portable phonographs that you can buy in a little case that you can transport. What I mean, this must be extraordinary for you to see. What does it bring to mind when you see that?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't actually seem that it doesn't seem that remarkable to me, because my life spanned the age of the long playing phonograph record and the 45, and their relative disappearance. So, but I've always, you know, had, you know, somewhere in the house there's a closet with all the LPs, although only my daughter plays them now. But for me, it never entirely went away. I'm not sure what it would look like to someone who's a bit younger and hadn't had phonograph records as a platform, seeing even younger people play them. But some of the musical arguments, the arguments of musicians for the superiority of analog recordings, I'm not musical enough to understand those arguments, but it impresses me to see that they even exist.
Well, the
it may be neurological rather than purely nostalgic. Well, you're actually having a different neurological experience of the same recording by listening to it in analog.
It's very interesting. I mean, certainly I've been part and overheard so many of those arguments that can become quite heated and passionate. You were mentioning film a moment ago, and I'm wondering if, I know you're in the midst of writing, even if the world looks gloomy, dark, and goofy, do you take yourself to the movies?
Well, I go with, I never take myself. I go with friends, and I haven't. I haven't been. Oh yes. Well, actually, I did go recently. I went to Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak.
Yes.
Which I absolutely love, but I love all of his work. So that was my most recent cinema experience. And the rest of it, I think I get by osmosis, via osmosis on Twitter.
Right.
It comes through in little bits and pieces. And sometimes I surprise myself remembering that I haven't actually seen something. It feels as though I have.
This is so interesting, Bill, isn't it? Because just a moment ago, you and I were talking about this notion of what I take to be a primordial experience. And now we have all of these what one might call secondary experiences that make us feel as though we've had a primordial experience.
Indeed, although I'm dubious about ranking.
Yeah, I would imagine you would be.
I'm not sure about ranking. I've long suspected that what our descendants will find quaintest about us is that we made distinctions of that sort. That they'll be looking back and they'll be going, so strange, they didn't think Facebook was real. there's a wonderful, weird book the title of which I will probably be unable to remember, but it's a collection of first person accounts of people of Victorians encountering new technologies. And they're, you know, it's taken from diaries and letters. It's not famous people, it's just ordinary people. And the one that always struck me was an Anglican clergyman who went to a garden party, heard an Edison phonograph talking, and went home and wrote this completely terrifying description of this demonic, satanic, mechanical voice speaking to the children in the garden, and how this probably presaged the end of the world. And he was just writing for himself, so it was, you know, he wasn't exaggerating. And I thought, oh wow, he had this absolutely intense experience, but I don't think I could say that what it caused him to fear came to pass.
Right.
And I think of the Anglican clergyman whenever I see someone going off on a really really good rant about some new technology or media platform.
Yeah, because it's so easy to find fault with it and to think that these new technologies just separate us instead of in some way bringing us together in a different way. I mean, it's so easy to feel that our screens are a screen that puts us at odds with other people, when in fact, you know, you were mentioning earlier Twitter, it can also bring you all kinds of information.
Exactly. No, I agree, and I think it's something to do with the tenor of our era that allows us to be on both. I think we all find ourselves on either side of that fence.
Right.
Fairly regularly. It's an extraordinary time in which to be alive, and we're able to have these unprecedented experiences via this technology, and then suddenly we'll find ourselves on the other side, and it's all scary and alienating and new.
Yes. Bill, after our phone call now, what will you do? What will you go back to?
I will probably go and have a small quick lunch, check Twitter, and attempt to have a character pick up a conversation in the book I'm working on, which is a conversation which she's having with a voice in her head, which is actually a sort of Siri-like artificial intelligence that has, it's an artificial intelligence that happens to be in this woman's head, and it happens to be coming more fully to consciousness in a way that's causing it to have an existential crisis. So it's a woman having a literal conversation with a voice in her head, and the voice in her head is either having a nervous breakdown or coming to some sort of great self-revelation. And they've only known one another for about 3 hours. So whenever I put that one down, going back to it is very difficult.
Well, Bill, it's been a real, real pleasure to talk to you. And I hope that that voice comes to you after this conversation. I certainly look forward to reading what will certainly be a very interesting new novel. Are you working on it now to finish it in the near future?
Well, I would hope so. And I think that just having been able to have another wonderful conversation with you can only further the process.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for saying that. And I look forward to seeing you in person, though it's been a pleasure also to hear your voice on this phone call. I send you all my very, very best.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Paul. I hope to see you again soon.
I hope so, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.